Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to the In-Between podcast. I'm your host, Mel Barrett. In this episode of the In-Between, we're following up on the Darlie Routier case from last week. If you didn't get a chance to listen to last week's episode, you'll probably want to listen to it before you dive into this one. Darlie Routier was accused and convicted of brutally murdering 2 of her 3 children and is serving a death row sentence in Texas. Her mother, sisters, ex-husband Darren, and adult son Drake do not believe she is guilty of this crime. And I have to say, based on the evidence, I've got a lot of questions about the investigation and the outcome myself. Darlie is working with the Innocence Project, and they are focusing on testing DNA found at the crime scene, allegedly. I'll update when I know more about that. But I plan to do a deep dive on this case like I did in the first season, which was about the Pamela Smart accomplice to murder trial that happened a few years before Darlie's trial. In my investigation into the murder and trial of Greg Smart and the subsequent conviction of his wife, Pam Smart, for accomplice to first-degree murder, I was able to uncover new evidence and anomalies that are currently being used to request, via habeas, a new hearing in Pam's case. I didn't necessarily set out to prove Pam Smart's innocence, but I did want to understand how we got here. And as I've said before, when a case doesn't sit right with me, I feel the need to unravel it and get to the why. In Darlie's case, there's so much that doesn't make sense. And I wanted to better understand where Darlie's family is coming from and why they so wholeheartedly believe in her innocence. So I reached out to Danelle, her youngest sister, and she graciously agreed to speak with me. Here's our conversation. I'll note that it is edited down in parts because Danelle and I discuss current legal processes that Darlie's lawyers don't want made public. But otherwise, it's a very candid discussion. Hey, Danelle, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for giving me a call back. So I just wanted to talk really briefly. I'm planning on covering Darlie's case on the podcast. You know, what I did with the Pam Smart case is I did an 8-episode deep dive, basically, on everything that happened. You know, I tried as best I could to stay unbiased about it, but obviously I have my opinions.
Yeah,
and the same can be said for Darlie. When I went back and revisited Pam's case and started doing the podcast, I was like, what other cases was I convinced as like a young adult of someone's guilt and not really sure now? And my immediate thought was Darlie and that experience I had with the cops and being terrified and all that stuff. You know, with Pam's case, it was, she's the teacher who sexually assaulted her student and then convinced that kid to kill her husband. That's the sort of National Enquirer headline, right? With Darlie, I think most of the people that I know and most of the people in the public cannot tell the difference between Darlie and Susan Smith. Just a reminder, Susan Smith was convicted of murdering her 2 sons, 3-year-old Michael and 1-year-old Alexander, in 1994 by strapping the boys into their car seats and rolling her car into a lake in South Carolina. But before she was arrested and charged, she first claimed a black man, Susan and her children were white, had kidnapped her sons during a carjacking. Her defense claimed she had mental health issues, which caused her to mislead her husband, the police, and the public. She was sentenced to life in prison in 1994 and is eligible for parole.
Susan Smith is a heinous human being who did a really horrific thing, and Darlie is not Susan Smith. So the reason I wanted to sort of open up this dialogue with you is that I know Darlie can't get on the phone. I wanted to get an idea from you about where the family is in the process, because I want to report on this story, but I also don't want to skew the media either. So I want to make sure that I'm doing the right thing while she's sort of fighting for her freedom. So if you can give me an idea of where you all are and what's happening with the case, that would be super helpful.
Of course. Yeah. We are really close to finding what we want to find. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of in the process. And you were also right about a fingerprint. There's not just a latent fingerprint, but also a patent fingerprint. A fingerprint left in blood.
Yep.
That one is referred to as 85J. But there was also a good significant amount of fingerprints that were collected at the crime scene that were never tested, never ran, and more importantly, never turned over to the defense. Mm. So we didn't even know they existed.
Wow.
So those fingerprints are being processed and worked right now, kind of simultaneously as the sock is being worked on. And so we're hoping between one of those two items, we have some confirmation that will eliminate Darley from everybody else's opinion. Mm-hmm. And then we can move forward with whatever that will look like. Okay. Ultimately, we're wanting it to end in an exoneration. And I myself am very confident that that will be the case.
Yeah.
But it is kind of touch and go because we have been down this road for so long. And when you know something so wholeheartedly, you know, it's hard to keep getting let down because it seems so clear to us. Mm-hmm. You know, the evidence is very clear to us that everything she said is supported by the evidence.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's constantly feeling like, when's the other shoe going to drop? Or, you know, when are we going to be let down again? When are they going to tell us the next bad news or whatever? Mm. But so far, for at least the last little bit, it's been nothing but good. Really, really, really hopeful and excited about that. And we're hoping, you know, just in a matter of weeks, we'll have some kind of update. And yeah. It hurts every single time you build up your hope and you get into that place where you're preparing for good news. Mm-hmm. And then, bam, they slam a door in your face and say, you know, not today.
Yeah, the justice system is very interesting. And I'm starting to understand that judges have so much power.
They really do. And there's no checks and balances. Like they say, we've got the appeal process, but in all reality, that's not checks and balances because mm-mm. everything is stacked in favor of the state, no matter how you look at it from the very get-go.
Absolutely.
The whole investigation and everything involved in any of these cases is driven by the state. So right. They're in charge of all of it. And that really sucks because every bit of your case revolves around the evidence that they collect. Right. And if they don't want to collect it, they don't have to collect it.
Exactly.
You know, there's nobody there to say, hey, you didn't do your job.
My interview with Danelle will continue after a quick break from our sponsors, who, along with you, dear listeners, keep my show alive. So thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
The 90s were sort of just all over the place, especially with women who were convicted. I just think that there was a special place if you know, with Lorena Bobbitt and, you know, Mary Kay Letourneau, all these people, they were really tried. I'm not saying everybody is innocent, but most of those women were tried in the media and their sexuality was just like the overwhelming story.
You know, sensationalized them, made them criminally, you know, responsible for things that are not criminal. Ridiculous. The things that were put out and the things that were twisted in all of those cases, they just pick and choose what they want for the world to know. And for the most part, if you're a defendant or you're part of that defending family, you're under a gag order. So mm-hmm. you can't even defend yourself if you want to.
Right.
Because it's always a one-sided narrative.
Did they have any other suspects or were they just pinpointing Darley from the beginning? Do you know?
Yeah, I do know, actually. So with Darley's case, Rollett was very inexperienced. They knew right away that they would need somebody to consult. And so they consulted a fellow named James Cron. So James Cron was a fingerprint expert. Mm-hmm. He'd been trained by the Dallas Sheriff's Department. And his role at the Dallas Sheriff's Department was the lieutenant of the evidence locker. And basically, the keeper of the fingerprints is what the lawyers called him. So he was not a crime scene investigator. Right. He was not a police officer. He was a civilian employee of Dallas Sheriff's Department. Yeah. Okay. And Rollett felt like it was appropriate to consult him. He had a relationship already with some of those, I don't think it was the chief so much as it was some of the lieutenants at the Rollett Police Department. They were buddies and I guess had done some training with him on fingerprints for some of their newer officers. And so when they called him, he agreed, he showed up. And so the crime happened at 2:30 in the morning. He was there by 5:30 in the morning. Mm. And by 6 a.m., they had only done a walkthrough that consisted of 20 to 25 minutes, I think is what he said. And at the end of his, we're going to use air quotes here, investigation,
yeah,
he laid out the scenario that there, I think his exact words were, there was no intruders here, or there was not an intruder here, something along those lines. Mm. So that was all the Rollett Police Department needed,
right,
because clearly he's, you know, he's better at this than they are, and he's more educated, and they're going to trust whatever he says. And he planted the seed without even having evidence collected. Like, mm-hmm, they hadn't even done anything at the crime scene, only walked through it. They had secured it and walked through it, and that was it. And majority of the evidence that they ended up collecting that they used against Darley was actually just contamination. And I don't know of one single piece of evidence that can't be explained away as contamination. It all kind of falls into that category. So it really was based on James Cron's opinion at 6 o'clock in the morning that there was no intruder. And from that moment on, they never looked outside of Darley. It was completely focused on Darley from 6 a.m. on June 6th moving forward. So just recently, I'm going to say 6 months ago or so, I started doing some research, just kind of, you know, just relooking at things in her case. And I started calling some of the people that had called in leads, mm-hmm, as early as the 7th. And those individuals, when I was able to get in contact with them, they told us that their lead was basically brushed away, and they were told that they had it figured out. And the lady that called on the 8th and said she'd seen a suspicious car was told, don't worry about it, we already have it solved.
Yeah, and I do remember that one. I remember hearing about the car. And then there was something else about the business too, wasn't there?
So Darren worked next to a man that had done some insurance fraud in the past, mm-hmm, and Darren had had conversations with him about insurance fraud and maybe having the house robbed. I don't know if that may be what you're referring to. There wasn't really, yeah. So that wasn't called in, and we didn't even know about that until maybe 3 or 4 years later. My stepdad had some guys that worked for him that, you know, he paid just cash. They were like day labor. Mm-hmm. And Darren had thought maybe my stepdad would know somebody that could set his house up for a robbery. Mm-hmm. And then he'd claim insurance and he would get all of his belongings back. And then he would just pay them from the insurance, whatever he collected.
Right.
And Darren did admit to having those conversations, but he never planned anything. It was never... my stepdad told him, nope, I don't know anybody that would do that for you.
Yeah, I mean, they were having some financial difficulties, but that's not enough of a motive for Darley to hurt her children.
And really, I would say that the financial angle was really kind of exploited. It was blown into something bigger than what it was. Darren had $120,000 in receivables due to him. Mm. So they weren't broke,
right,
but anytime you're self-employed, you'd kind of have to wait on that cash flow to come in.
And tell me about it.
While they weren't fixing to go into foreclosure. Their house was current on its bills. They had been late on their last two house payments, but it had been caught up and it was squared away. They were not at risk of foreclosure. They didn't have any crazy, you know, huge financial debts outside of what their assets were. Mm-hmm. So the financial hardships, I mean, they were 26 and 27 years old.
So young. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, who at that age is really financially stable in a place where they don't worry about money? Like, I really don't know anybody outside of people that are born wealthy. And Darlie and Darren both kind of, they were not born rich. Mm-hmm. They worked really hard for their money. And so they were really enjoying what they were earning.
Yeah.
And everybody was taken care of. They were providing for more than just their own family. So it was, in my opinion, they were successful in their business endeavors. And yes, they did like to enjoy their money, but financially, it was not dire straits like the picture was painted. So, and even if they were, Darren had $800,000 in life insurance. Darlie had $500,000 in life insurance. The boys had rider policies that just came with the life insurance they bought, and it was $5,000 each. So it was not even enough to cover their burial. We still were out of pocket almost $3,000 to bury our boys.
Do you think that the defense made a good enough argument for her, or she could have had a better defense?
I think that we were really shortchanged with our defense. I think they tried as hard as they could, but it was shut down every time they requested something. It was an immediate denial.
Okay.
They had asked to have the trial moved out of Kerrville because that was such a conservative area, and we knew that that was going to be bad for the case, and he refused because the judge had a retirement home in Kerrville and planned to retire there.
Right.
So it didn't matter if that was going to be a fair place for Darlie or not. It was convenient for him. Mm. So that was shut down immediately. No, you cannot have a change of venue. And then we asked for a extension because we had changed counsel. It went from Doug Parks, who was court appointed and actually was really doing a fantastic job. We just didn't know that the defense gets denied everything no matter who you are. Yeah. So we just felt like he was being denied everything he asked for. So maybe we need somebody bigger and stronger and better and more impactful. And Doug Mulder became her lawyer. And again, we were refused on everything we requested. So Doug Mulder ended up having something like 6 or 8 weeks to prepare for a death penalty case.
Right.
And from start to finish, it was only like seven months was the time frame they had to prepare for this trial. We were still getting results from testing the day the trial opened, like the first day of trial, they were still having results come in from testing.
Wow.
So it was very much rushed and our lawyers were not prepared. Doug Mulder really was an excellent lawyer, but he thought that he was, persuasive enough or charismatic enough that he could handle the state's experts on cross-examination. And in reality, he did do a really good job of pointing out the errors and the flaws in both the fiber expert and James Cron, the consultant, and with Tom Bevel, the blood spatter expert. He did a great job of kind of showing where the flaws were in their testimony, but we never put anybody on the stand to represent a different view. We just disputed what the other side said.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was because we were paying Doug Mulder and he was already dipping into his profits to defend Darlie. And, you know, that lawyers like to make money. And he knew that there probably wasn't going to be a lot of money to be made on that trial.
Right.
So he would have had to have paid for the experts out of that $100,000 retainer that we'd given him. And he just didn't do that for whatever reason.
I feel like most of the cases hinge on experts and they're so expensive and most of the defenses cannot afford them.
You think that we have, as a layperson that doesn't have any reference of the justice system, you think that it's set up fairly because that's what we've been taught our whole life. And in reality, there's absolutely nothing fair about it. It's so stacked against whoever the defendant is that you almost have to present an alternate person. Otherwise, you're not going to walk away. You're going to go to jail no matter what the crime might be.
Yeah, that's why I asked if there was. That's why I asked if there were any other suspects that the defense could have, you know, shown that there was any sort of alternative suspect in the case, but it doesn't seem like there was. So what do you...
They never looked for any. Now, we have investigated this case to the bone. Like, we've exhausted all of our resources trying to kind of dig into every possible avenue. And there is several that very well could have been involved or would have been really good leads to check up on and would have been so simple to investigate. Like back then, yeah, things were real life and real time. And now, you know, we're looking at things 10, 20, 30 years later, and it's hard to track those people down. Memories are faded. You know, people are dead. Things have changed. And so the investigative side on the back end has been really difficult. And it would have been so much easier had they done it the right way the first time around.
My interview with Danelle will continue after a quick break from our sponsors, who, along with you, dear listeners, keep my show alive. So thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
They investigated to support their theory. Mm-hmm. They didn't let the evidence tell the story. Yeah. They told the story they wanted it to say.
I think that happens more often than not, unfortunately.
Absolutely, it does.
So what do you think it was? Do you think there was one specific thing that convicted Darley, or was it public sentiment, the news media? What was it?
I think the biggest part was the media painted her as such a villain, mm-hmm, that she walked into that courtroom with the jury thinking that she was a monster from the time they sat in those chairs. One of the jury members said that all that she knew about the case was that she was a blonde from Dallas with big boobs that killed her kids.
Yep.
And that was all she knew about the case. Well, that is a bias from day one. Mm-hmm. Like that's the opposite of what you want for a jury. Yep. But unfortunately, again, we really couldn't do anything about it. Where our jury pool was not the same as Darley. They were small town, majority of them were not very educated, and they lived in a very conservative area where Darley lived in Dallas, where everybody had breast implants and mm-hmm, everybody dyed their hair and everybody was, you know, flamboyant and beautiful. And if you weren't, then you didn't fit in.
Yeah, you're in Dallas County and it was the late 90s.
Yeah, yeah. Big hair and fancy jewelry was really popular then. But those things didn't go without, you know, the boys were spoiled just like Darley was. And mm-hmm, it was Darren that liked to spoil Darley and Darley liked to spoil the boys. And we definitely were judged tremendously based on their purchases and, you know, what they did with their free time and how they lived their life. And reality, looking back, they lived a very normal life. And if you look at the dirt they found on Darley, she was a fucking saint.
Right.
I mean, at 26 or 27 years old, most people don't have such a clean life.
Well, before all this happened, it sounds like she was actually an amazing mother and she took care of other kids.
Yes. I didn't go into depth about the Silly String video and the Cliff Notes episode of this case. So for those of you who are not familiar, a video captured by the local news media was released right after the memorial for the boys that showed Darley and her family celebrating with Silly String around the gravesite. Not a great look. But was it evidence that she murdered her boys? Was it enough evidence to convict her? And finally, was there more to the video than the prosecution showed the jury? Danelle says yes. You be the judge.
It definitely was a huge part of it. And the jury said that they watched that anywhere from 7 to 9 times in their deliberations. So we know that that made a huge impact on the determination for Darley's guilt or innocence. Now, what was not presented and not even discussed, I don't even think it was talked about, was that whole scenario was the idea of a 16-year-old. So my other sister was planning a wedding. Darley was going to renew her vows and Dana was going to have a wedding and in this next year. So they were planning things and it kind of consumed their free time and they were talking about the details. And the boys, Devin and Damon, had asked if they could spray Silly String whenever they walked down the aisle to leave instead of throwing rice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Dana and Darley thought about it and decided with white dresses that colored Silly String probably would stain the dresses. Mm-hmm. And so we'll wait and we'll save the Silly String for something else. And Dana had promised Devin, the oldest, that they would do Silly String at his birthday party, which was coming up.
Right.
well, he didn't live to see that. And that really weighed on Dana. And as a 16-year-old, you're still a child, and we don't know how to grieve. We weren't prepared for, who is prepared to lose a child when you're a child yourself?
Let alone two children. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In such a brutal way. So it was really hard for Dana, and that just really weighed on her that she never got to do the silly string with them. And so she bought silly string on her own and brought it to the memorial. And they had already sent out invitations for Devin's birthday party. And so instead of, you know, calling all these kids individually and telling them we're not going to have a birthday party, they donated all of the gifts from the birthday party, whatever somebody, if they had already bought gifts, they brought them, and we donated them to a children's house in Rowlett that Darlie had done some work with in the past. So it was in good intentions, and it was to honor little boys. And that was all Devin could talk about for, you know, like 2-3 weeks prior to was his upcoming birthday, was that next weekend we were going to have a swimming party. And it was, you know, how many more days till my birthday? When do I get to turn 7? And, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so it just, it felt like that was what we were supposed to do. We were supposed to honor Devin. And that's how a child, Dana was 16. She felt like that would honor them. And we did it because it felt right in the moment. Mm-hmm. And we just really had no idea how that would be shown to the media and how it would be perceived. And they just, he just chewed it up and spit us out, and it looked awful. But they never talked about the 2 to 4 hours before that, where we did have a memorial. We did pray. We were crying. We were, you know, having that kind of a somber, grieving moments with the pastor on at the gravesite and consoling each other and hugging and all of that.
Yeah.
And so when you get to a certain point, you know, you kind of, for a lack of better words, you run out of tears. And that's kind of where we were at. We'd been crying for like 10 days straight. Mm-hmm. And it was just so emotionally draining that you just get to a point where you're kind of numb and you don't have any feelings. And I think everybody except for me was medicated at that point because of the amount of anxiety and stress and trauma that everybody had gone through.
Yeah.
And so reality was that we really were kind of numbed by medications and everything that was going on. We were just in shock. And I also think that a big part of that was we were confident that Rowlett was going to solve this. Mm. And they had stopped us. They'd asked us if we could meet them prior to the memorial. And so we stopped at a Home Depot parking lot, and Jimmy Patterson met us there. And he, I don't remember, I think he was getting something or returning something to Darlie. And we all got out of the car. I was standing right beside Darlie. Darren was right beside him. And Jimmy Patterson, I can see it to this day. He looked at them and said, we got him. We've got fingernail, or we've got DNA underneath your fingernails. And so we're going to be able to solve this case.
Wow.
Well, we were just ecstatic. We didn't know anything about DNA. I, you know, as a 13-year-old child, you kind of think, oh, that means they'll know his name. Well, that's not how DNA works. And there really wasn't any DNA, as best as we know. Nothing was ever collected from Darlie's fingernails. And that was just a bold-faced lie to hopefully give us some false hope, I guess. I don't really know what his motive was, but they knew we were doing the birthday party. He gave us that information. We were confident they were going to solve this case. And so we felt a little bit of relief and confidence in their abilities. Mm. And that was so false. We were just completely lied to, and like the wool was pulled right over our eyes. It was they were the wolf in sheep's clothing. We thought they were protecting us, and they were really digging our graves.
Wow. Wow. I've never heard about that, obviously, but that happened right before the memorial or after?
No, that was on our way to the memorial. Wow. So we stopped before we got there. Yeah, that was fresh news. Like, we hadn't even shared that information with the rest of the family yet. I think we shared it with them once we got to the memorial. And so, again, we had that relief that, all right, they're going to find them. I mean, DNA, certainly they'll be able to just plug in that information and it'll generate a name, and then we'll arrest him and he'll go to jail and it'll be solved. And that is not how that works at all.
So you were 13 at the time, is that right? Or 16?
Yes.
You were 13, and then your sister was 16.
Correct.
So the night that it happened, or I guess it would be the morning at this point, and Darlie is going into surgery, what did you all gather at the hospital? What was happening that morning?
Yes. So my mother got a call from the neighbor, and the neighbor told my mom, like 3 o'clock in the morning there, actually it might've been before 3 o'clock in the morning. It was probably like, 2:40. And she said, there's been an incident. Somebody broke into Darlie's house. The boys are dead and Darlie will probably not survive either. Jeez. And that was coming from a nurse that lived across the street that had seen Darlie's injuries. She'd seen the boys. She actually walked into the crime scene and saw a lot of what was going on. So she was very pessimistic that Darlie would even survive. And so my mother jumped in the car and drove to the crime scene and waited outside until somebody directed her and said, go to Dallas. And so that my mom went to, actually, I think her best friend drove her to Baylor, Dallas, and she waited to get an update. And they told her Darlie was still alive and that she was going into emergency surgery. And we didn't get to see her until, I want to say it was almost 8 in the morning before we got to see her. But I didn't even know anything was going on. I actually was at one of my very best friend's houses, and her mother came and woke us up probably about 7:30 that morning and said, your mom called. She said, the boys are at the hospital and she wants for me to bring you to the hospital. Well, I think it was 2 nights before I had been over there and the boys had a rash, and we were thinking maybe they had chicken pox. Maybe that's why. I mean, I was a child. I had no idea.
Right.
So I thought they were going to the hospital because they had chicken pox. And so she drove us there. And I remember we stopped and got breakfast. The radio was on and kind of a update came through the radio. Like the radio host started talking and she immediately turned off the radio. And I thought, huh, that's weird. And then she was asking us questions about, what we were going to do and what was the night before like, cause it was a birthday party, and just, little conversation to distract us. Mm-hmm. And whenever we got to Baylor Hospital, she walked me to the front of the emergency room. And I remember walking through the emergency room and seeing familiar faces and thinking, that person looks so familiar to me, but I couldn't really place their face. And then we walked through the double doors where the trauma area was, and my mom was kind of standing in the corner, and she kind of put me in a corner and looked at me and said, I have some really bad news. Mm. Somebody broke into Darlie's house and the boys were killed. Mm. And Darlie was attacked and we don't know if Darlie's going to survive. And I remember hearing the words and I remember thinking, absolutely not. Like, are you kidding me? That's not possible. And then the next thing I know, we're sitting on the floor in the emergency room, kind of just sobbing. Like we weren't even speaking. It was just tears and tears and tears. And there was people kind of gathered around us, I guess really making kind of a shield so we weren't on display for the rest of the world to see, and patting our backs and whatnot. And so they kind of scooped us up off the floor and put us into the family room, which is a really bad room that if you have to go to the family room, it's usually bad news. Mm. And so we waited in there and we prayed, and Darren's cousin was a pastor, and I remember him praying, and I remember feeling a sense of calm. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a weird, like, it's going to be okay. Whatever this is, it's going to be okay. And then we just lived at the hospital for like the next 48 hours until they released her. Mm. And from that point moving forward, it's all just kind of a blur. We were doing whatever we could to accommodate the investigation. And if they said jump, we said how high. Mm. And at one point, one of Darren's friends said, you know, I'm kind of concerned. I think you, based on what he was seeing in the media, he had suggested we get a lawyer. And Darren and Darlie dug their heels in and said, no, innocent people don't need lawyers. Mm-hmm. And it was the biggest mistake of our life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know that that's a tough question to answer. And I appreciate you being, you know, your candor. I also imagine yes. the juxtaposition between the devastation of losing Devin and Damon, and then sort of the elation the next morning when Darlie made it through. You must have been struggling yes. with your emotions. Your family must have just yes. been going through it. I can't even imagine.
Yeah. It is such a mix of emotion. It really is.
Yeah. And then to, you know, feel like you know, Darlie's okay, at least, out of this. And then the police are, you know, immediately coming after her. It's awful. I'm so sorry that happened.
It sucked. That's no doubt.
My interview with Danelle will continue after a quick break from our sponsors, who, along with you, dear listeners, keep my show alive. So thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
I know that Darren and Darlie have divorced, but I also know that Darren is, you know, believes in her innocence. Is your family still in communication or connection with Darren? I would assume so, because he has Drake. Is that correct?
Well, Drake is a grown man now, right. So he is completely independent. Okay. And I actually had Drake for a few years was graduating high school. Yeah, he moved in with us right before his senior year, and we got him through his senior year. And then when he graduated, he moved back to Lubbock before he decided what he wanted to do with the rest of his life.
Okay.
So he's grown and living independently, and Darren is still around. I talk to him, not weekly, but regularly. I talk to Darren. So I was so young when he became part of my life that I don't remember life without him. Mm. So he feels like an extension of Darlie to me. Right. And I've always kind of kept that relationship. I saw them go through this together. And I know that Darren has a good heart, and that in my opinion, there was not anything that he knowingly or willingly did that could have contributed to this. Mm-hmm. And his life was destroyed just like Darlie's was.
Yeah.
I mean, he may be a free man, but he'll never be free, right. You know? So he is a good man. We still do communicate, and he does still support Darlie 100% in her innocence. And I would say that they don't communicate actively, but I would say they're still friendly. He would do whatever he needed. If he needed to do something to help Darlie, he would do it.
And I know this is a tough question, but the last that I heard, Drake had been diagnosed with cancer. How is he doing?
Complete remission.
Oh, okay.
So that was kind of a God thing. I at that point I was the only medically trained person in the family. Mm. And, I had been talking to Drake about coming and staying with us for a senior year, and convinced him to move down to where we lived in Wills Point. Mm-hmm. And he moved in, and 2 weeks later, we took him to Children's Hospital, and he was diagnosed with leukemia. Oh. And it was really kind of like scary. I mean, obviously it was scary, but it was close. Had he not moved in with us, I don't know what the outcome would have been, because it would have progressed faster than we could have treated. So it was a blessing that he moved in with us. He went through the entire treatment, 2 years of pretty intensive treatments, and then 5 years was the span that you really watch for. And he's outside of that 5-year window and has had no further recurrence. And he does have some lingering neuropathy in his feet from the chemotherapy, but we'll take it. Yeah. That's definitely a fair trade.
And he is communicating with Darlie. They've communicated mm-hmm. his whole life. Yeah, that's what.
Yeah, he still loves his mommy very much, and you know, that's all he's ever known is this life. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I call him my little Harry Potter because he's so resilient. And we have not treated him like Harry Potter, but he is just so persistent at being happy, and he tries very hard to stay on the. On the positive side of things, and it can be hard at times, but he still definitely loves his mom and communicates with her. And so we're thankful that he is so resilient.
I would like to tell this story so that more people can become aware. I think a younger generation now, you know, sort of millennials and under, are really starting to look at these old cases and go, wow, that was so fucked up. Like,
it's awful.
It wouldn't happen today. You know, like, that's sort of the thing. Yeah. I don't know if it would happen today. There's plenty of really messed up cases that are happening today. But my main goal is to get a younger audience, because I'm 49. Anybody who's like my age or older, they've sort of written these stories off as they're done. And we dealt with that in the 90s and blah, blah, blah. But younger people really want to discuss these cases and talk about the corruption and talk about why this happened. So I'm really trying to hit, you know, a younger generation that can, you know, talk about these cases and sort of, get the ball rolling again. And then you have all these like sort of social media investigators who are going out and finding new information. So I just think putting the information out there is super important.
We know what we know, and it's so hard that other people can't see what we know. Mm-hmm. And I think that the biggest thing when you were talking about a younger generation, what I have found is that even people my age, a lot of them, I'm 42, I'll be 43 this year. A lot of people in this age group don't even know the case. Exactly. A lot of them don't remember the media presentation mm-hmm. of it. And I think that that's the biggest thing now. That age group didn't get inundated with all that negative publicity and all of the false information and misinformation and, you know, it was all twisted in a certain way to make Darlie look guilty. And so that generation didn't get it. And so they're able to really look at the evidence and not the BS that was blown in our face, mm-hmm. like the smoke screen. They didn't get that. So a lot of the people in these younger generations think Darlie's innocent, and they can see the actual evidence for what it is, not what somebody is telling you it should be.
Yeah, for sure. Well, she's working with the Innocence Project now.
Yes.
And I'm assuming, does she have a lawyer representing her outside of the Innocence Project, or just the Innocence Project?
We're actually really lucky to have Steve Cooper still working on the case. He was her original appellant attorney.
Okay.
And he's been pro bono for, I'm going to say, 20 years now. And he still is part of, like, he feels like an uncle to me, kind of like an extension of the family.
Mm-hmm.
He is still involved, and he still does whatever he can to help. Vanessa Podkins is really kind of running the appeal. She was able to join forces with the Dallas County Conviction Integrity Unit. And we are so lucky. We are so lucky that Dallas has that, because they're doing wonderful things for the legal system and really kind of restoring the faith in the district attorney's office mm-hmm. that they do care about the actual justice, not just convictions.
Right.
So they are also on board and working alongside the Innocence Project, hoping to really dig down into it and find the actual answers, some real meat that we clearly were never given. So hopefully that will lead to an exoneration in the next 6 months or less.
Do you mind if I stay in touch?
Absolutely. Go ahead and call me with any questions you have. I'm certainly not an expert in anything outside of knowing Darlie. I know Darlie very well, and that's about all I can be an expert to, but I have really tried to educate myself in pretty much every area of Darlie's case mm-hmm. in regards to the expert witnesses and all the evidence. So I can I may not know the exact answer if you have questions, but I can definitely find it and give you at least what would be expected to be the right answer.
That's amazing. So, thank you. I'm going to reach out to Darlie as well. So if you end up talking to her anytime, just let her know that I'm going to reach out. via email. I already have her set up on my Securus and everything. So I really appreciate you. I know your kids just got home. I really appreciate your time. And thank you so much for sharing your story with me. And I'll let you know when the episode comes out. Okay.
Yeah, that's exciting. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you looking into it. And like I said, just send me a text with anything you got, any questions, and I'm glad to help.
Okay. Thank you so much, Danelle, and I'll talk to you soon.
You're welcome. All right, Mel. Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'd love to know your thoughts about what you've heard so far. Like I've said before, this is just the tip of the iceberg, and I plan to open this wound and shine some sunlight on it. I want to believe that our justice system gets it right most of the time. But when there's an inkling they might not have, and there's a mother sitting on death row, I think it's important we get to the bottom of the story and absolutely make sure that the jury got it right. If you like my work, please continue to support Grab Bag Collab, and please head on over to Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to rate, review, subscribe, and share. Your support makes it possible for me and the Grab Bag team to continue to tell these important stories, so thank you. The In Between podcast is written, edited, and hosted by me, Mel Barrett, and is a production of Ruby Grace Productions. Thanks to Amber Hunt for editorial guidance, as well as the rest of the team at Grab Bag Collab, Amanda Rossman and Daisy Egan, for their support and guidance. If you want to binge great content, head on over to grabbagcollab.com and drop $5 for a membership. You won't be sorry. Follow the In Between podcast on Blue Sky, Facebook, and YouTube at In Between Pod, and on Instagram at The In Between Pod Official. On TikTok, you can follow me at Jack of All Trades DC. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.